Okay, the topic of this shir is, can you be good without God? That's for the recording. It's a bit of an odd topic, because it seems that the question has an obvious answer. Of course you can be good without God. Don't we all know good people who are not religious? One could also have asked the converse. Does being religious guarantee that you'll be good? And one could note that obviously the answer to that question is also no. So why is this a question of interest at all? Because I think the answer is not as simple as it seems on the surface. It's more complicated. In fact, the question splits into two questions. Because when we talk about good, sometimes we're talking about actions that are good, and sometimes we're talking about agents that are good, people who do actions. And they aren't the same. And indeed, neither one implies the other. Let me illustrate. Paul is drowning in the river. Peter jumps in at great risk to himself and pulls Paul out. And when he gets him onto the shore, he rolls him over and takes his wallet from his back pocket and runs. All Peter wants is the money. If he had been able to fish the wallet out of Paul's pocket while he was drowning, he'd have taken the money and run. But it's very difficult to get the wallet out of a pocket of a person who's drowning. So he saves Paul's life in order to get the money. Now, saving Paul's life is a good action. Saving any human being's life is a good action. But Peter, who does this, is a vicious criminal. He's vicious. His action is motivated by vicious motivation. His evil and the goodness of the action don't contradict one another. He's evil and the action is good. Similarly, car is broken down at the side of the highway and someone pulls over and says, "Looks like you're having trouble. Can I help you?" The driver says, "I hope so." So the fellow says, "Listen, I know something about cars. Open up the hood." Opens up the hood and he looks inside, pokes around, reattaches a few things, says, "Okay, now try it." And the driver puts his key in, turns the key, and there's a boom! And smoke starts pouring out of the engine. And this fellow says, "Gosh, I'm awfully sorry. I must have made a mistake." Okay, now, the engine is in meltdown. Terrible action with terrible consequences. The fellow, however, is a good person. He wanted to help. He hoped he could help. He was willing to sacrifice his time and effort to help. So here you have a good person with good motivation performing an action which is disastrous. So when we talk about good, the first thing we need to do is distinguish. What kind of good are we talking about? We're talking about good actions, or we're talking about good people, good agents. And to cover the subject thoroughly, we ought to talk about both. So let's take them one at a time. Let's start with actions. Can one's actions be good, wholly good, without God? With no thought of God, no mention of God, no relationship to God. Would the absence of God in any way compromise the goodness of someone's actions? I want to give you a couple of analogies without bringing religion into the question, and then I'll show you how they apply to the goodness of action without God. Imagine parents and a child who go through the Holocaust and who become separated. The parents think the child have died, and the child thinks the parents have died, and the parents and the child separately make their way to America. The child is young enough to be retrained and to master the local culture, if it should be called culture, and works his way into a position of wealth, buys a home in Beverly Hills, and he has a charity policy. Every month, a certain percentage of his income is put into a special account, and he gives out that whole account every month to charity. The parents come to the United States, it's hard for them to learn the language, they don't have the skills to be employed, and they end up indigent beggars. And they go from city to city, begging. Decades later, they come to Los Angeles. And in asking around to whom it's worthwhile to apply for charity, they are told that in Beverly Hills, there's a fellow who's quite wealthy, and he's very charitable. If you go to him, you'll certainly get some support. So they come to him. It's June 29th. And they knock on his door. He opens the door. He doesn't recognize them, and they don't recognize him. Child and his parents facing one another. And they say, "We need charity." And he says, "I'm so sorry, but the June account has been exhausted. If you'll come back on July 3rd, the new account will be open, and I'll be glad to help you." And they say, "But we have a free ride to San Francisco tomorrow. We can't afford to turn down a free ride." And he says, "Well, I'm very sorry, but I can guarantee you the account will be open on July 3rd, and it will be exhausted by the end of July. And if it wasn't meant that you should get from it, then other people will get from it. That's how I give out charity." And he turns them away. Isn't this tragic? These are his parents. And he's not helping them. Of course, there's nothing wrong with him. He's a good person. No failure in his character. No failure in his motivation or his priorities. But the action is tragic. If it's not obvious yet, let's make it tragic. They take the ride to San Francisco. On the way, there's an automobile accident. And they're killed in the automobile accident. And some investigative reporter decides to dig up the past and figure out who these people are. They have no identity documents, they don't have any records. And he succeeds, and he publishes in the LA Times the history of these people who were killed in the automobile accident. And the son picks up the paper, sees the pictures, and he reads the account, and he realizes that he turned away his own parents, which resulted in their deaths. How will he feel? Now, careful. He shouldn't feel guilty. He's not guilty. He didn't do anything vicious. He wasn't irresponsible. He just didn't know. Still, the action was terrible. Even though he isn't a vicious person and he's not guilty, it's a terrible action. Or, more realistically, until about 130 years ago, when people had fevers, the medical profession believed in bleeding. In the United States, if you ever visit, which I'm not recommending, you go to a barber shop, the barber shop has a pole with a red stripe. The red stripe means "we bleed you here." Advertisement for bleeding. We don't do that anymore. Can you guess why? Because it's not healthy. Now, what about all those doctors who did it throughout their careers? They were really hurting people. They were really injuring people with all the best intentions. Imagine a doctor on his deathbed. He's on his deathbed and the new research comes in that bleeding is actually injurious to people. He's done it all his life. And he reads this paper as he's dying. What is he going to think? How's he going to feel? I dedicated my life to improving people's health, and with my own hands I injured them. Won't he feel terrible? Not guilty. He did the best that he could. He did the best that was given to him in terms of medical knowledge at his time. Still, he accomplished the opposite of what he wanted to accomplish. Example of how an action can be objectively wrong, even if the person who performs it is innocent. Person who performs its character is perfectly virtuous, and still, the action can be objectively wrong. Now, a second example. George, is nobody here named George? Okay, because George is my favorite example. I don't want anyone to feel bad. George is tramping through the forest. He's hiking. Hours from civilization. And he comes across a grove of trees, fruit trees. And they're laden with fruit. And he thinks, look at that. Apples and pears. And right here in the forest. Isn't that wonderful? And that's actually ripe fruit on the trees. It's the right season. So he goes over and he takes off an apple and eats it, takes off a pear. Ah, absolutely delicious. He has a bag. He starts putting some fruit in the bag and takes it home with him. Suddenly, out of the underbrush, he hears someone tramping. And the fellow who sees him and says, "Thief! Thief, you're stealing my fruit!" And he says, "What do you mean, your fruit? I'm out here in the forest, you know. This is no man's land. Nobody owns this forest." And he says, "You're trespassing on my land and you're stealing my fruit." At this point, our traveler is, you know, George is beginning to feel that maybe he needs some assistance. You know, maybe we can get a helicopter with some police in here. This guy's nuts. And the fellow says to George, "You crossed my fence, and my fence has on it clear signs posted, no trespassing." George says, "What do you mean? I just walked through fires. There was no fence at all." So the guy says, "Show me how you came." So George retraces his steps, and at a certain point, the fellow says, "Where's my fence? Somebody's removed my fence." At this point, George is sure he's dealing with a psycho. But then the fellow says, "Look, come with me." And he starts to walk on a radius. And 50 yards away, in that direction, there's the end of a fence. And the fence goes off into the distance, and clearly posted are signs, "No trespassing." "Now, says the fellow, George, come with me." And walk the other way, and 50 yards in that direction, that's where the fence starts. And the fence goes off in that direction, "No trespassing." And there are clear signs that, at that point, fencing has been ripped out. So the fellow says, "You see, this is my land. You really are on private land, and you really have taken my fruit. You really have stolen my fruit." What does George do now? It's clear he's on somebody else's land. It's clear that he has eaten someone else's fruit, and his bag is holding somebody else's fruit. I think what George does now is he says, "I'm awfully sorry. I certainly didn't intend to steal. You see that the path that I took didn't cross your fence. I didn't see it. I couldn't see it, the path that I took. But of course, I recognize it's your fruit. Here," he hands him the bag. "It's not my fruit. It's your fruit." And he says, "I ate two pieces of fruit. I'll happily pay you for them. Because, although it was unknowing on my part, and it was innocent on my part, I really did take your fruit. I have no right to your fruit." Here again is an example of how an action can be objectively wrong, even though the person performing the action is innocent, virtuous, no critique of his character, his motivations, but the action is wrong. This is an examination of actions independently of judging the agents who perform the actions. Okay, now let's apply this to our context. Suppose that God creates the world and gives us everything we have. Our lives, our intelligence, our resources, our talents, our context, environment, friends, profession. Suppose every moment of my life I'm being sustained by what God gives me. Shouldn't I have a tremendous debt of gratitude to God? If God asks me for something, if God says, "I want something from you," a person with appropriate morals will say, "You have benefited me in so many ways, and you're asking this. If it's within the scope of what you've given me, if it's commensurate with what you've given me, then I have a moral obligation to accede to your wishes because you have given me so much." Isn't that the way we would express gratitude in any other circumstance? Gratitude is a moral principle that applies to anyone who has benefited me. My parents, my teachers, my friends, the bank, my athletic trainer. And if God has benefited me, it applies to him as well. It applies across the board. I'm not saying that if there's a God who's taking care of me, then I can ignore everybody else. But gratitude applies wherever I have received a benefit. And have received enormous benefit from God. Then I have a certain moral obligation to respond when God asks something of me.
the same obligation I would have to service my parents when they need me. Now that fellow in Beverly Hills doesn't know that it's his parents. He's not aware that it's his parents. So we say, he's a virtuous person, he has good character, but his action is disastrous. He's turning away his own parents. Similarly, we may say, a person who out of ignorance turns his back on God, although he may be a virtuous person, his actions are subject to a tremendous critique that he has not responded to his moral debt of gratitude to God. Very often you hear people say, I just want to be a good person. And I don't find religion relevant. I don't find it persuasive. I certainly don't find it a necessity. I just want to be a good person. Well, being a good person at least includes living up to all your obligations. And if what you enjoy is a gift from God, then to ignore obligations to God is to fail to be a good person in your actions. Your actions are not all good actions, because some of those actions violate the obligations we have to God. Similarly, there is considerable discussion about what it takes to own something. What does it mean to be the owner of something? Okay, that's a deep and very contested philosophical issue. I don't want to go through the subtleties of the issue. But one thing's for sure. If I will create on this shtender, right here, a three-layer wedding cake out of nothing, I'm not even borrowing energy from the rest of the universe. I'm creating an addition to the sum total of mass energy in the universe. One, two, three. Bang! There it is. You know, with sculpted icing and the two figures on top. And then it's my cake. If I created it out of nothing, then it's mine. That's a clear case of ownership. On those grounds, if God created the universe, he owns it. Now, put aside whether he owns us. That's also subtle and difficult philosophically. I don't want to get into anything that's controversial. But you can own hills, you can own valleys, you can own streams, you can own lakes, you can own vegetation, you can own airspace. We recognize ownership for all those things. Well, if he creates the universe, yes, present tense, he creates the universe out of nothing continuously, then he owns it. Now, God says to Jews, thou shalt not eat pigs. Translation, they're my pigs, and I don't give you permission to eat them. So a Jew who eats pigs is a thief. Kashrus is not some ethnic identification. If you happen to identify with Jewish history and want to express your ethnicity and so forth and so on, if God is creating the universe and he says to Jews, don't eat pigs, then eating pigs means you're taking the property of God without permission. And that's theft. Okay, you didn't know. I understand, you didn't know. Neither did George know, tramping through the forest, that the trees were privately owned. He didn't know that. Still, even though he's ignorant, still, when he takes the fruit, he's stealing. He's just stealing unintentionally. But the action is not an appropriate action. Someone who proposes to lead a good life without taking God into account risks that a great many of his actions will be objectively inappropriate, because if there is a God and he creates the world and gives us what we have and owns it, then his wishes determine what it is that we are obligated to do morally, and if we violate those obligations, then our actions are not going to be appropriate actions. This has a very large-scale consequence, which I've hinted at already. I'm going to draw it out in detail, and then I'll stop for questions on this half, and then we'll move to the other half of the good character, being a good person. In many quarters, Jewish laws are divided into two groups. There are the moral laws and the ritual laws. I know about this because that's how I was drug up. moral laws like give charity, pursue justice, don't lie, don't steal, don't kidnap, don't murder. And ritual laws like don't light fires on Saturdays, and one evening in the spring, make sure to eat crackers. Okay, you live in the wrong place, you eat two evenings in the spring. And a week in the fall, wave certain species of plants. Rituals. What's the point of the distinction? The point is that the moral laws are very important. They're very important because if you violate a moral law, then you're not moral. That's not nice. Whereas if you violate a ritual law, then I guess that means you're not a ritual, which is more or less a throwaway. I mean, if you like being a ritual, so you can do some ritual laws. If not, not, it doesn't matter. From the point of view that I'm sketching for you, the whole distinction is incompetent. Because what the distinction forgets is that we have a moral relationship with God. And that if these commandments come from God, then they're all morally obligatory. All of them. None of them is simply discardable on the grounds that it's just a ritual and it doesn't matter. If you thought you lived in a solely human world, a world populated only by other people, then the rituals perhaps wouldn't matter. Perhaps. But once you put God into the picture, then the rituals become enforced by our relationship with Him. And that's a moral relationship. And that being the case, the goal of leading a good life without God becomes literally impossible. And at the very least, a person who wants to lead a good life owes it to himself or herself to investigate whether there aren't obligations above and beyond your neighbor, your community, and the state. If there are, then they have to be taken into account in trying to lead a good life. Questions up to here? Because, from our point of view, it's an ongoing process. And it makes a difference in all sorts of applications. Life and death become defined in an entirely different way. If He created the world, and I'm alive, then I possess my life, though He may have given it to me. If He creates the world, then my life is a continuous free gift, moment by moment. And then the continuity of my life can't be taken for granted. I don't have my life in my pocket. Whereas, if He gave it to me, I could be grateful, but if I give you a gift, it's yours now. You own it. That's what a gift means. If He gave me life in the past tense, then the life is mine. If He's giving it moment by moment, then I don't have it. I'm just receiving it moment by moment. It changes my conception of what I am. It changes my relationship to Him. It changes my attitude towards death. It changes a great deal. And this is carried out throughout Jewish expression. When you make a blessing on an apple, you say, Boirei pri ha'etz, which means create the fruit of the tree. Not bara, that He created, but creates. They're all present tense verbs. Yeah.
I found that your whole approach is like in sync with intuition, but I think that there might be a value to be counterintuitive, so that's what my questions are going to be predicated upon. You didn't define good, and you associated the person. You made a distinction between person and action as opposed to motive and action. And it's possible that a person ought to bring himself into the position whereby if his parents came to ask for charity and he didn't identify them as the people that they were, and he had a policy of being charitable between one date and one date when the account was open, then he ought to shrug his shoulders and say, I'm not at fault, I'm going to sleep soundly tonight because I turned my parents away because my motives were good. And similarly, the person that stumbled into the orchard when, despite the fact that he didn't identify that it was belonging to another person, he could easily say, no, I'm not going to give you back your fruit because it was your responsibility to make sure that there would be a boundary, a fence. As that was wanting in your case, I'm going to walk away with the fruit and I'm not giving it back to you. I think that that would be possible, and he could rationally legitimize that to himself. And A further thing I'd be interested to know is, I found it really interesting when you said that one is a thief if they don't make a bracha, etc.
I didn't say that.
Sorry.
You know that from someplace else, but I did not say that.
If they eat treif, because the pig belongs to Hashem, I was wondering whether halachically you'd be able to apply that logic to any sort of a lot, I'll say, that one does.
What?
If somebody is over a lot, I'll say.
A lot, I'll say, yes. Mm-hmm.
Whether that would be, you know, whether they would be subject to the category of theft.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me answer all three of the questions. First of all, and this is quite important, I think, in general discussion, you don't need definitions most of the time. I know it's the battle cry of the philosopher, define your terms. I think one ought to resist that battle cry. What one ought to say is, why must I define my terms? After all, reflect. You can't define all terms, because terms are defined in other terms. So you've got to come to the end of the chain somewhere. That's point number one. Yes, I define one term using other words. Should I demand a definition for those other words also? Then I'll use other words. Has to come to an end somewhere. There isn't an infinity of words. So at a certain point, you cannot demand another definition. That's point number one. That's a minor point. But the major point is this. Let's think. What does it mean to search for a definition of a term? What is justice? What is beauty? What is truth? What is knowledge? What is reality? What does it mean to search for the definition? Do we understand the term, or don't we understand the term? If we do understand the term, why is the need for a definition so pressing? If we don't understand the term, how could we adjudicate when a proposed definition is correct or incorrect? What is the logic of looking for a definition of a term? The answer, of course, is that we have partial understanding of the term. We're not totally in the dark. Good can't mean marshmallows. It can't mean submarines. Even yellow submarines. Right? Good can't mean torturing babies. There's a limit beyond which good isn't, doesn't have a candidate for a definition of that type. It's not that we're totally in the dark as to what good is. We know a good deal about good, a certain amount, and then there are other cases where the application is questionable and difficult. When someone proposes a definition, what do? We take the definition and compare it against the part we do understand, and we see if it fits. And then we ask, how well does it fit? Does it explain the part that it fits? Is it integrative? If it is, then I may trust it to clarify the part which I don't understand. Okay, now let's imagine that we are conducting a discussion using a term, and we use the term only within the realm that we do understand. Then we don't need a definition. Because this is the part of our understanding that we would use to judge the correctness of a proposed definition. And if this is overly abstract, let me illustrate it for you. There is no acceptable definition of truth. New books on defining truth come out every year. It's a difficult, unsolved philosophical problem. Now George is on the witness stand, and he says, I saw the crime in London, July 5th, and then others come and say, in London, indeed, you were with us in Shanghai. And now he's charged with perjury. And George says, perjury? Perjury means I lied under oath? Lied means I told an untruth? What, pray tell, is your definition of truth? And when, of course, the judge, oh, you don't have juries in this country, but the judges throw up their hands and say there is no acceptable definition of truth, he says, well, then you can't accuse me of perjury. Is that a good defense? I don't think so. Because saying you were in London with evidence that you were in Shanghai is a clear falsehood. There are difficulties with truth. There are difficulties, but not here. Here's not one of the places where there's a difficulty. So the demand for a definition should be met with resistance. Why do I need a definition? Where did I use the term in an application which is unclear and controversial? If a person has not made such an application of the term, the demand for a definition is invalid, and one should resist it. I don't believe that I used the word good in any controversial context. If you can point out a controversial concept that I used, I'll be happy to see it. That's point number one. Point number two, I simply will have to disagree with your proposed counterintuition. I think I have never, in all of my expositions of this idea, ever met anyone who said, when you discover you're on somebody else's land, eating his fruit, that you don't have to give it back and pay for it. Yes, you are virtuous. That doesn't mean the action was appropriate. A person who takes a car for a test drive, and the dealer was irresponsible in not tuning the brakes and injures somebody on the road, can say, I'm an innocent person, and it was an innocent event, but I feel terrible that I was part of what injured you. I think everyone will naturally feel that, and I think it's inappropriate to deny those feelings on the grounds that they have a contrary thought without any justification, without any evidence. I think everyone will apologize for taking the other guy's fruit. Yes, it is true. He has a responsibility. Suppose it was ripped up yesterday, and he had no time to investigate it. Suppose there was no way that he could have repaired the fence. So then, it's not his fault, and it's not your fault, but in the end, you ate his fruit. I don't see how you can say that. Because you did it innocently, therefore you don't have to pay for the fruit that you ate. In the end, you ate his fruit. What was the third point? Yes, I think the vocabulary you used means, I think you really agree with me, though you presented it as a disagreement. He will say, it's not my fault. That was my claim. He can say it's not my fault. I'm innocent as a person. I'm virtuous as a person. But the stuff of literature goes far beyond mere innocence. What they portray is people who are caught in tragic circumstances, and the tragedy causes in them a sense of regret that they were involved. If you are that doctor who's been injuring his patients his whole life in trying to help them, he cannot simply say, oh, but I didn't mean it, I had to use the best knowledge, and therefore it's of no concern to me. A person will not feel that way. What he will say is, I'm not guilty, I'm not vicious, I'm not a corrupt character, but what I have been doing actually has been hurting people. You find out that you're hurting people, wouldn't you say you were sorry? Wouldn't you apologize to your patients? Not admit guilt, but say, I actually caused you harm. And I feel terrible that I caused you harm, because my causing you harm was objectively bad, even though I'm not vicious and guilty in character for having done so.
See, I would just apologize for the reality. I wouldn't apologize for participating in that reality, because I'd be acting based on textbooks at the time, and I'd just say, look, life is tough. I'm sorry for your misfortune, but I'm not sorry for actually participating.
Well, I think what you're doing is you're using the vocabulary in your own way, which you have a right to do. For you, sorry means an admission that I'm guilty. If you want to use the word sorry that way, I don't mind. And if what you call apologizing for the situation rather than my participation, because for you, my participation means guilt, it's my point just in other terms, right? I'm not guilty, but I feel bad that I was involved without guilt in causing you harm. You know, we say, if somebody suffers, we say, I'm sorry. You're walking with somebody, and someone pours down water from the second floor, and it falls on the other person's head. Oh, I'm so sorry. What are you sorry for? You didn't do it, but you're sorry that the other person is suffering. Now, if you knocked over the pitcher and it spilled on somebody else's head, you'll say, I'm sorry, in a different way. Even if you weren't guilty, but you'll say sorry with a different feeling, because you caused it, even though you're not guilty. I think these are human realities. Yeah.
If we're taking two basic fundamental differences here, one in terms of being good with the relationship with God and one in being good without that relationship, is there anything that you can understand, maybe from a slightly more Jewish approach, in terms of how you can feel that involvement? In other words, at point A, you're doing an action with no thought, no involvement with God being there, in terms of a good action, as we've understood and what this good action is. And on the other side, you're doing that same action and you are consciously involving God. Is there a difference that you should be taking in as an understanding?
Well, there's an enormous difference, because I really have to give a little bit of background to what is an action. What is an action? An action is not the motion of your body. Avalanches kill people. Suicide bombers kill people. An avalanche is an event. A suicide bombing is an action. What's the difference? The difference is that a suicide bombing involves a conception, a value, and a goal, and a chosen means to the goal. If you want a word for all of that, it involves will. An avalanche is just snow or stones or mud falling down. So, we're talking now about actions. A crucial element in anyone's action is what he thinks he's doing and what he's trying to accomplish. It's not just his body moving. Indeed, people's bodies can move in the same way and the actions be very different depending upon what the inner reality is of the person who's performing the action. So now, a person might act in a way that in fact is consonant with what God wants. That just means his body's moving in the right direction. It's quite different from a person who consciously understands that these are his responsibilities as relating to God, as an action. It's an action rather than just an accidental motion of the body. So I think it makes an enormous difference whether the person is conscious of what he's doing and intends it. Yes.
So that will only be identifiably internally to that individual. From the external, you wouldn't be able to see the difference.
Often, from the external, you cannot see the difference. That's correct. And indeed, unless the person expresses himself, you'll never be able to tell. The only way you can access this internal reality is through language. If there's no linguistic expression, you will not be able to access this reality. That's an important point. The oldest linguistic remains on the planet are about 5,400 years old. It's a point to keep in mind. Yes?
I've got three questions, actually.
Yeah.
The first one is... the issue of like expressing gratitude and like an obligation to express gratitude. An example of like teachers or your parents or anyone who's sort of given you something that you should express. There's this sort of element of gratitude, and I can't quite understand. Is there an example of something that's God's has done for us that we should express gratitude for, like one specific example?
How about life? Receiving life moment by moment. As I answered this fellow back there,
is that the only one?
No, but you asked for one.
Anything positive? Like,
you asked for one. You said
that's a big one. But what about like the positive things that happen in your life? Are these examples of sort of gifts from God that you would need to give?
Everything that happens to you ultimately comes from God. Even if another person's involved, God puts you in a position where that other person would affect you in that way. So all of these ultimately come from God.
Okay, well, the thing I don't understand is, what about the hardship that you might suffer in your life? How does that sort of balance out? How should you express gratitude? I mean, if you're held hostage by someone who's feeding you just to keep you alive, but ultimately is keeping you hostage, I mean, should you express gratitude to that person?
Okay, this is a crucial point now. It all depends upon what you think the ultimate policy is that brings the hardship about. If you think there are essentially vicious forces in the universe, forces that just are destructive, then indeed, with respect to those forces, you should say that I hate them and I oppose them and certainly not grateful to them and I would like to destroy them or at least reduce their activity as much as possible. If you're a monotheist, then monotheism can make a big difference. If you're a monotheist, and if God is good, then what you understand is that all of those hardships serve a good purpose. They serve a good purpose. So, you're a four-year-old child. You tell him, you're coming to the dinner table, wash your hands. He does not want to wash his hands. He's not interested in the slightest. Well, you say, thou shalt not eat unless you wash your hands. He thinks you're a tyrant. Why can't I eat? Go and explain to him about microbes. Explain to him about disease. He's not old enough to understand. You go to medical school. To become a doctor, you have to learn organic chemistry. It's a pain in the neck. Hundreds and hundreds of organic molecules. You're not going to be a chemist. You're going to be a doctor. You're going to cure diseases. What do you need that for? They have decreed that this is important for your education. You don't understand why, but you can't get a medical degree without it.
We assume that somewhere in the wisdom of the medical profession has been found that this is an important aspect in a doctor's training, even though we may not understand in detail why that is so. A mature adult has been through this dozens of times. He has confronted requirements which looked to him to be arbitrary, which caused him a great deal of extra effort and sometimes suffering, and which at least were intended to benefit him, and very often do benefit the person in ways that he cannot at the time assess. Now God says, you've been through this, you know the world is structured this way, you know your own limitations, I'm telling you that this is good for you also. You won't see immediately why it's good for you, but I'm telling you it's good for you also. If you have had the experience of people knowing you well, knowing you better than you know yourself, then this might speak to you. I exercise regularly. I usually run 3 miles in a half hour, 3 times a week, 4 times a week. A year and a half ago, a fellow who runs my gym said to me, I would like you to add a run, 4.5 miles in 45 minutes. I said, but what about, you know, small increments? What about working into it? I'm 62 years old. He said, I know, do it anyway. I think you could do it. I said, I think you're nuts. That's because I'm an American. See, that's the way we talk. You would have said, I beg to differ. But as a matter of fact, I took him up on it, and to my surprise and shock, I was able to do it. He knew my capacities better than I did. Okay, he's just another human being. He's a professional trainer. That's his job. He runs marathons with a black velvet gown. What about God? God says, I know this is good for you. I know you will benefit from this, even though I don't see it. So that's the way we take it. We take it that these things which cause me pain are a benefit. They are actually improving my life, even though I don't see it, certainly don't see it at the moment. And that's why we...
It leads to your ultimate death, though. Well, is that just improving your afterlife?
Look, our attitude is that everybody's going to die. If you didn't get it from the obits and the times, you can get it from Genesis. Genesis says everybody's going to die. And we don't measure the value of a life by its length. We are commanded to try to preserve life, but some of the greatest people in all of Jewish history had quite short lives. So, for us, the fact that a person is going to die is an accepted part of the picture that God set up, at least after Eden. So, if it leads to my death, then it means that God says, what you needed to accomplish has been done, and therefore there's nothing left yet to be done in your life in this world. Okay, maybe... All right, I'll take one more question, then maybe I should go to the second half.
Okay, just try and be quite quick. In the story about the fellow who stumbled into the orchard, the George guy, is he halakhically accountable for stealing the apples? And if he is, does that not mean that people can't be good for that? And okay. If he's not, I was going to say, then does that not mean that...
I stand right, and I didn't answer that question when he asked it as well. Yes, every transgression, and I wouldn't limit it to a lotase. Every transgression, whether it's formally an assay or a lotase, it doesn't matter.
I'm
okay. Any transgression does mean that there is an element of theft. Because if a person performs a transgression, he's using his body, he's using his mind, he's using his energy, he's using his intelligence, he's using his education, he's using items that have been made available to him. So yes, in answer to the question that I didn't remember to answer before, yes, every transgression involves an element of theft. And according to halakha, for sure, a person will have to pay for the fruit that he ate.
Oh, yeah, this is for answering the question.
Yeah, okay. Thanks very much. Oh, that's fine. And therefore, you cannot be blissful in your ignorance. The whole burden of my remarks is that if it is someone else's orchard and you're eating it against his permission,
then you're stealing. You can't be blissful in your ignorance.
Right. So the original statement that, of course, you know, some people argue about, I've got to think about now, getting a bit nervous having to define the good side of it.
No. So now, what did I do? I started by distinguishing good actions from good people, good agents. Right. And I decided to talk first about good actions. And I take it that a child turning his parents away at the door is a terrible action. And doctors hurting other people's health is a terrible action. And stealing somebody else's fruit in ignorance is a terrible action. That's why we feel bad about them. That's why we feel upset about them, even though we don't feel guilty. And if we're doing the same thing to God, then our actions are not good actions. I don't think theft is controversial as an application of goodness. I don't think ingratitude to one's parents is controversial as an application of goodness. I don't think injuring people's health is controversial as an application of goodness. I picked examples which should be perfectly understandable and agreed upon by everyone. That's why I picked those examples. Any question? Well, to foreshadow what I'm going to say in the JLE on Wednesday night, if you are observing or examining a different concept, why would you apply G-O-O-D to that concept? G-O-O-D is an English word. It's an English word for a concept that's part of a particular culture. If another culture has a concept that's considerably different from our concept, why would it merit the title G-O-O-D? Correct.
I mean, in the history of our culture as well.
Good, but I don't think that any of the examples that I gave has been historically relative. And
well, I mean, not in terms of relative, but I mean, certainly, I mean, just as a basic kind of metaphor point. I mean, if you're looking at terms of, I don't know, kind of classical example, maximizing utility, for example, I mean, you wouldn't then have that kind of obligation of gratitude necessarily. I mean, in which case, so what I'm saying is, why is it that we.
I'm making the metaphorical point. I'm making the medical point that words cannot stretch their meaning beyond a certain limit. Now, what happened to maximizing utility is that because utilitarianism stretched the words beyond their acceptable limit, it's rejected as an ethical theory. Well, I think about everyone except a certain small subclass of philosophers who I think are disqualified in terms of their intuitions. According to utilitarianism, if there are 10 people on an island, isolated from the rest of the world, and will die without contact with the rest of the world, and if 9 of them will get pleasure out of torturing the 10th, they're obligated to torture him. That's wrong. Period.
I mean, I'm saying, so do we take, with your position, do we take strongly to kind of take on this rather than...
Go back to what I said to him about defining your terms. Where do you start when you launch a meta-ethical project? A project of defining your terms. You don't start from zero. Good isn't going to be marshmallows. Right? You know certain things about good. Those things you will use to check the proposed definitions. You're not at a position where you can reject everything. I oversimplify it a little bit. I mean, this goes back to Carnap, my goodness gracious. This ancient history in philosophy, what he called reconstructing a concept. On occasion, you can revise some of your proposed basic understanding. But the vast majority has to be held in constant, because if you don't, you don't have that concept anymore. So as long as you restrict your discussion to the area that you understand well enough to use to judge proposed definitions, then you're not in danger of doing something for which illicit, which could be corrected by offering a definition. Published an article in the journal Metaethics, so I'm familiar with the discipline. Okay, let's briefly talk about the other half, and that will be finished. What about goodness of character? What about good motivation? Being a good person? Here, I think the situation is more subtle. Here, I think it is possible to be good without God, though it is much more difficult and much less likely to succeed. The reason for this hinges on the following question. Do you think, I mean, this was Socrates' question, can virtue be taught? Can your environment make you more virtuous? I find that this question calls out a curious asymmetry in people's judgments. When I ask whether the environment can make a person virtuous, there's puzzlement and considerations on both sides and perhaps some controversy. Let's start with the opposite. Can the environment deprive a person of virtue? Can the environment make a person vicious? Here, everyone will agree. Of course, there are people with vicious attitudes, with vicious priorities, with vicious behavior, and it's the environment that made them so. When we want to relieve some of the responsibility, then we are happy to blame it on the environment. It was this poverty, it was his lack of education, it was the fact that he came from a broken family and a society of broken families. The values, because of their deprived economic circumstances, became violent values. You can have all the explanations with which you are all familiar, and they're very easy to generate. Well, if a deprived environment can program a measure of viciousness in its inhabitants, in its population, then a morally rich environment can program a measure of virtue in its inhabitants. You can't have one without the other. It can't be possible to program viciousness and not program virtue. It's just not possible. So if you are convinced that the environment can be blamed for certain types of vicious behavior, then you should be convinced that by structuring the environment appropriately, you can produce virtuous behavior. And indeed, I think this is what we observe. Now, let's imagine, I have to speak now as an American because I don't know the English reality well enough. They ask the average American, how many hours a year does he invest in becoming a better person? The answer is zero. Becoming a better person is a non-subject. You can go to Barnes & Noble and you can search all the shelves. You won't find a single book whose topic is how to become a better person. How to lower your blood pressure through meditation? You have it. How to save your failing marriage? You have it. How to please your boss and get ahead in business? You have it. I was traveling once and I saw an airplane, I saw an advertisement for a business seminar. And one of the courses they're teaching at the business seminar is business ethics. And I thought, what country am I in? Business ethics? In America? Then I looked at the bottom line. If you have ethical practices, you'll keep your customers longer and your employees will be happier and there'll be less turnover in the employees and they'll be willing to work extra hours and so forth and so on. Yes! Business ethics, because it produces more money. That's right. That's the bottom line. They don't lose sight of the bottom line. Become a better person is a non-issue. One can have all sorts of explanations, democracy, so you can't teach it in the schools and so on and so forth, but that's the bottom line. Becoming a better person is a non-issue. Now, let's suppose you have a culture which puts a great deal of emphasis on becoming a better person. Three times a day, there's at least a cursory examination and admission of failures. And there's 10 days during the year when that's the subject of one's consciousness throughout the 10 days. And there are fast days during the year where one meditates on these matters. And the heroes whose lives are recited to our children as bedtime stories are moral heroes. And moral accomplishment is held up with the greatest of respect, the greatest of honor. So you have an environment that is richly structured to produce virtuous behavior. Can the environment be trusted to produce virtuous behavior? Look at alcoholism. There was a report in the United States of a conference of alcoholics, and one of the speakers said that he thinks the cheapest and most effective treatment for alcoholics is to make them all Jewish. Because the rate of alcoholism is so low in the Jewish population that, and there's no recidivism, I mean, you know, they're just not alcoholics. That and the other methods are risky, and there's a tremendous amount of recidivism. So the pressure of the public, when the public believes in a value, will produce more virtuous behavior. I live in a place called Har Nof. It's a neighborhood in Jerusalem. There's about 4,000 apartments there. Every religious neighborhood has its own telephone directory for the numbers of people that you know and you want to be in contact with. At the beginning of the directory, There's a list of free loan societies. People who run free loan services out of their homes just because they want to benefit the public. What's available for free loan? Power tools, baby equipment, cribs, bassinets, tax advice. People who need tax advice can't pay for it. There are lawyers who dedicate, we give them free advice. Wedding dresses. When you get married, an enormous and totally useless expense is the wedding dress. It can cost $1,500. Okay, it's only dollars. For pounds, it's 1,000 pounds. That's a lot of money to spend on some cloth which you will never use again. We don't do that. There are people who run a free loan society. You go in, you take the dress of your choice, you wear it to the wedding, you clean it and bring it back. It costs $35. And they have dresses for all the family if you want. For the mothers and for the sisters, right? Why should you spend money for that? And this is this person's contribution to the community. For celebrations, tables, chairs, floral displays. Your baby loses its pacifier on Shabbos. That's a disaster. That baby can cry for 18 hours. No, there's a neighbor who has a supply of pacifiers for anybody who needs one and can't get one. There's medicine. You have medical professionals who stock medicines, and if you come with a they call it recept, a prescription, then you can get a refill of the medicine in the middle of the night, on a holiday, on Shabbos, when you can't get it from elsewhere. These people have people knocking on their doors day and night. That's their service to the community. You have a lost child service. Child is lost on Shabbos. What do you do? Call around to the neighbors? No, you can't do that on Shabbos. So someone finds a lost child. There are designated families that house these lost children until the parents realize the child is lost and they come and pick up their children. That means every Shabbos, these people are sitting there with screaming and crying children. That's their service to the community. Because this culture produces a mindset that you owe something to the community and you should do something to service it. Free lectures. There are free lectures all the time for men, for women, and for combined groups. Now I challenge you, go to some other neighborhood and find me something similar. Motivated by anything you like, find me something similar. I've lived in a lot of places and I've traveled to a lot of places. I've never seen anything remotely similar. So I say that, yes, a person could be good without God. Yes, it could be done. It's possible to be done, but it's much harder and it's much rarer. As you have a culture that dedicates itself to producing virtuous behavior and virtuous character, then you're going to have a much higher performance of virtue in that culture. That's the angle, the aspect of the goodness of the person, the agent, as against just actions. Okay, now Rabbi Ross generously offered my brain for your service, so if this or anything else has led you to questions you want to ask, I can stay for a little while.
If the pig is like, we're not allowed to eat pig because it belongs to God and he doesn't want us to eat them, we don't have to understand why, but we have to understand that that's the case, then it's not our moral obligation to protect these pigs from other people eating them.
Well, let's understand, it's only Jews that must not eat them, right? Non-Jews are perfectly permitted to eat them.
Okay, but if our belief is that these are sort of creatures that God doesn't want to be eaten, or is it just that God doesn't want to be eaten by Jews?
That's it. It just wants to, not just not to be eaten by Jews. But I will accept your point. There is some obligation to protect them from other Jews. Okay, that goes together with all sorts of obligations that I have. I can't reform the whole world. As one of the great leaders of the 19th century said, when I was young, I thought that I would remake the world, and then I thought maybe I'll start with my city and maybe my neighborhoods. Maybe the members of my family, and then you realize that the place you have to start remaking is with yourself. Start by remaking yourself. And then, hopefully, if you succeed in remaking yourself, that will have an effect outward. So, having a responsibility doesn't yet mean that I have to act on it. It's what philosophers call the prima facie responsibility. It goes together with all the other things that I have to do, and then I have to decide. I have to set priorities and do the things that are practical for me to do.
Do everything, following Torah. Why why don't we have it in us as Jewish people, like complete knowledge from birth? So obviously there's secular Jewish people who don't follow anything because they don't know it, but why doesn't he implant that in us so that we all know it, so that we can all do it quite easily?
That's a very interesting question. Let me add to the question.
That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure that I have a good answer for it. Let me add to the question, because the point here is there's a deep point involved here. Rav Elias Svei, Rav Shiva in Philadelphia, should live and be well. I heard him speak at a Gudas Israel convention 26 years ago, and he made the following point. You should honor your parents. What's the point of that mitzvah? Well, we say, because we reproduce sexually, there are two people in the world to whom I have a special relationship. They brought me into the world, and in the normal case, they cared for me and they invested in me. I have a special relationship with them. The mitzvah of honoring your parents tells me how to express that special relationship. Okay? Said Rav Elias Svei, that's exactly backwards. That's exactly backwards. That's using the biology to explain the mitzvah. The truth is that the mitzvah is a much deeper reality. It's a prior reality. And we ought not take the biology for granted. We ought to question the biology. Why are we a sexually reproducing species? Because it's a mitzvah of honoring your parents. And if you don't have parents, you can't perform the mitzvah. The mitzvah comes first, and the biology is created to fulfill the mitzvah. It's exactly 180 degrees the opposite of what we normally assume. There's a midrash, a statement of the Zohar as well. God looked into the Torah and created the world. The Torah is the blueprint of the world. If you ask, how come there is a bulging window over there? The answer is because in the plans it had the bulging window. You don't say, how come it's written the bulging window in the plans? Because there it is in the building. It's backwards. The plans come first. The building is built to conform with the plans. Okay, now he asked, why is it that human beings have a longer maturation period than any other species, both in relative terms, life expectancy, and relative to, and in absolute terms, number of years? Listen to what he answered. He said, God communicated his will to mankind on isolated occasions, to Adam, to Noah, to Abraham, to the Jewish people at Sinai. All future generations have to get that information from tradition. When you're young, when you're still immature, you depend upon your parents for almost everything. And almost everything they tell you is immediately verified. This tap gives you cold water, and this tap gives you hot water. Well, being a full-fledged, full-blooded Jewish child, when your parents aren't looking, you turn on the tap and you wait for the water, and you see, is it hot, is it cold? This is your kindergarten class. And when they read the names, your name is there, just like they said. They teach you your numbers, they teach you your colors, they teach you your space concepts. I know that some people get it from Sesame Street. What a tragedy. What a tragedy. Right? Almost everything your parents tell you is immediately verifiable. And during that period of time, they communicate to you the tradition of what God wants from the world. That's why there's a long maturation period. Now, you ask, okay, that's one way to do it. But another way to do it would be to implant it in us. Why not implant it rather than have it trusted to this kind of tradition? Especially since, as you also pointed out, the tradition can break down. Just as you can injure a person physically, so you can injure a person by giving him misinformation or failing to give him appropriate information. That's also injuring a person. Last week's parsha, for those who read it, Jacob is described as stealing Laban's mind, his das, because he didn't tell him he was running. Just holding back that piece of information. It's called Ganeva's das. So you ask, why doesn't God program it into us so that we should know it, at least to know what it is that we should do? I don't know. It's a very good question. I'll have to think about it. Thank you for the question. It's a good question. Yeah.
We spoke a lot, especially in the beginning, about gratitude and everything else. Obviously, do we advocate doing things just because of gratitude, as opposed to things that are more inspiring? In other words, I suppose it's a split question also. there's that part to it. And also, what about the inspiration part of it? How does one feel that inspiration?
You're a brave man.
You could ask that question in the same room with your wife?
Yeah, but I
just out of gratitude?
I had the same question.
I see.
Okay.
Wow.
Question.
Terrific.
That's why I asked it.
Terrific. That's terrific.
That's
terrific. Terrific.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. I should have been doing this for the tape the whole time. That's what they told me to do. I always forget. The question is, the question was, in his terms, is it appropriate to do something just out of gratitude? I'm not sure exactly what the word just is doing there. Or maybe one should do things that are inspiring, and I suppose that means that gratitude isn't always inspiring, or sometimes other things are more inspiring than gratitude. So you have to play off gratitude against being inspired. And how does one pursue inspiration? Let me make this vivid if I can. Someone's drowning in the river, George, our friend, and Peter jumps in and pulls him out at the risk of his life and does not take his wallet and saves his life, and George is very grateful and so forth and so on. Now, 2 weeks later, Peter comes to George and says, I need a loan of $500. At the same moment, a neighbor, with whom George has only a very superficial acquaintance, says to George, I need a loan of $500. And George has $500 to lend, and only $500 to lend. And he flips a coin. Something wrong there? Something going wrong there? Peter saved his life. And the other guy is a neighbor with whom he has a nodding acquaintance. Doesn't he owe something to Peter? Wouldn't it be grossly immoral to say, I know you saved my life, but that doesn't count. To me, you're a stranger. And if I only have 500 to lend, I'll just flip the coin and give it to whomever comes up, heads or tails. In a case like that, I think we feel that because Peter saved his life, George is in his moral debt. Of course, you can't collect this in court. When they say you can't legislate morality, what it means is you can't legislate the whole of morality. One does hope that the laws are moral. One does hope that. But you can't legislate the whole of morality. Here's a piece of morality you can't legislate. But clearly, he can't simply turn his back on it. So gratitude is a moral obligation to be taken together with other moral obligations. It sometimes has to be sacrificed to others. But it's a root moral obligation. Now, I hope, maybe I'm just out of sync with the times, thank God. I hope that when you do something you know is right, you get a certain satisfaction out of that. I did something right. I did something good. I did something which is part of the ideal fabric of the world. Even if you're not religious, you don't have to be religious to have values. We're going to talk about that at the JLE tomorrow night. This is a very widespread misconception. I'm going to talk about it. It's widespread among religious people in particular. But to feel that you did the right thing, especially if there's resistance, now, inspiration, yes, not is it always inspiring to do the right thing, or not equally inspiring. When you are parents, I'm not wishing this on you, but if you like parents like everybody else, there will be some times when your children will be screaming in pain. Especially babies. It happens to them. Colic. A child can cry for 2.5 weeks straight. We had one. I don't know why they're worried about the child's trauma. I think it's a parental trauma. You're walking the floors, carrying the child, singing to the child, playing music, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. I've been doing this for a week, you know. I'm dead on my feet. Is it inspiring? It gets less inspiring as the days wear on. It's my child. It's my child. Would I want somebody else to do it? Carry my child? No, thank you. Not if I can hold my child and help my child through that kind of pain. So, I think we measure the rightness of the action and the significance of the action not only by the experience of inspiration. We measure it by standards of what is needed and what my responsibilities are.
And yes, a person needs a certain amount of inspiration to keep going. I think that's right. And one should seek inspiration. That's quite true. But one should not confuse inspiration with one's root moral responsibilities. And that's something which, and gratitude is certainly one of them. Yeah. You see how a little snippet of a girl's life could be misinterpreted. Well, the story goes like this. She was going to the grocery.
How old?
She was 5 at the time. She was 5, 6. And she's going to the grocery to pick up some items for the house, which for her is a great privilege. She's going alone with money to buy something in the grocery, you understand? You have to put yourself in the mental set. She's crossing the road. She'll ask an adult to help her cross the road, going by herself. That's an august performance for a child that age. And she gets the few things that her mother wants. The kids fight for the opportunity to go to the grocery. I mean, what are we talking about here? It's unbelievable that you can get a response like that. These people aren't parents. They can't be parents. If they were parents, they'd know better. Anyway, she gets there, and then she looks at the bags. Now, she has enough materials to fill one of the larger bags. But there's only one large bag left, and the rest are small bags. So she said to her mother, I thought to myself, suppose someone comes in and needs to buy a lot of groceries. So they'll need a big bag. I can make it home with 2 small bags. But someone else might need the big bag. So I decided to leave the big bag and take the 2 small bags. I think that's breathtaking. You know, she's thinking already about what someone else might need, whether she really needs it, and therefore she did something to help make things life easier for somebody else. Now, this is a girl. First of all, she's 5 years old, going on 11. She's very bright and very aggressive, and her teachers are in love with her because they can talk to her like an adult. You know, when she's 7 or 8, you know, they're already talking to her about what should be done in class. And she's that kind of self-confident, strong, and very bright girl, and she's just naturally thinks, maybe somebody else will need something, and maybe if I do it this way, it'll be more convenient for somebody else. I think that's beautiful. And I think that's what we inculcate. Not by browbeating them, but just by giving examples. And when the child sees the parent do something, and the parent says, well, maybe if I do this, it'll make noise for the people on that side of the house, so I'm doing it on this side of the house because it'll make less noise. So the child says, oh, that's what my parent does, that's the way an adult behaves, and don't all children imitate adults? Don't they all want to do what the adults do? If the adults drive, they want to drive. If the adults tie their shoes, you know what happens when you teach a child to tie his shoes? He ties his shoes 50 times in a row. Why? Because I can do it. I can do it. Look, watch. And there it is. It's tied. Let's do it again. Right? He ties it again. He's thrilled with his new ability to do something. If they didn't have that instinct, they wouldn't learn to do all the things that they need to learn. But they want to do. They want to be independent. We gave out ice cream to all our children. And our youngest at that time was 8 months old, right? We gave cups of ice cream with spoons. And there's this 8 months old. So we put it in a cone and put it to his mouth. And he starts screaming. We couldn't figure it out until we realized he also wanted a spoon. He also wanted to eat it with a spoon. I wasn't able to eat it with a spoon, but everybody else was eating with a spoon. So why didn't he get a spoon? And when we gave him a spoon with a cup, he was happy. 8 months old. That's the way they are. They want to be able to do. So going to the makolet, to the grocery, to them, that's a thrill to be able to do that. And then to think about somebody else, if that's the way their parents behave, so then for them it's natural. That's what you do. You think about other people and you think about how you can help them. Her child. We'd give money to the kids from time to time, and we'd see that she never had what the other kids had. So after a while, months went by, and we asked her, what's happening to all the money, the money that we give out from time to time? She says, I'm saving it to make a free loneliness fund. She was 8. She'll make a free loan fund. $1, $1, $1.50, $2, $3. She's saving it to make a free loan fund. She's 8 years old. Because she wants to help other people who are less fortunate. I think that's beautiful. Yeah?
I'm sorry to get back to this point. I feel that I have to leave because I've got to be sure that the farms get a paradigm shift in the future. About definitions. The reason why you essentially said that what's the point of defining something because you're going to have to borrow other words to associate and you're not going to define these other words, you're going to be putting one context and fitting it into another.
I'm sorry. Let me make my point clear so that we discuss what we're talking about. My point. I said a universal demand for definitions is impossible because the language is finite. That's a minor point. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't ask 25 times in a row and say, I've got enough words for 25. My main point was that there are certain cases where you shouldn't ask for a definition at all. Not even the first one. Even when there are plenty of words left over to be able to make the definition. That was the main point. First one was just an illustration of how you can't always ask for a definition. That was a kind of, you know, limiting point to infinity. And the main point was that when you ask for a definition... Sorry
to stop you, but when do you think one should...
When the term is used in an application that is controversial. For example, in ethics, what tends to be controversial are cases where you have a competition between two or more ethical or moral considerations. Somebody made a promise, and fulfilling the promise will cost nothing. Time, effort, concern, sensitivity, responsibility to other people, fulfilling the promise will cost nothing. There's no controversy whether he should fulfill the promise or not. But now, let's suppose fulfilling the promise will mean that he cannot do a service for his mother that his mother desperately needs. So now we say, now we have a problem because he did promise. On the other hand, his mother depends upon him and he owes certain things to his mother. So I have a conflict between moral considerations. That's when morality becomes controversial. It becomes controversial when there's a conflict in moral considerations. Now, I say, if you are careful to use the term, any term, in the area in which it's not controversial, where we understand it clearly and where we agree, then the demand for a definition is inappropriate. If you use it in an area where it is controversial, then the demand for a definition, or at least some justification for the application in this area, is appropriate. So if one says it's good to tax the rich in order to service the poor, one could say, just a moment, you are taking money from the rich against their will. So you are sacrificing their freedom for their benefit. Are you so sure that it's good? Why do you think that it's good? Maybe we should investigate what you mean by good in this case. But if you say it's good to save people who are dying at a cost of $0, how do you define good? Is idle there. Because it's obvious that it's good. That's not a controversial case. So once you, as long as you stay within the area that's well understood, then you don't need a definition. It's inappropriate to ask for a definition. That's the point that I'm making. By the way, I don't think I've said anything tonight that's really controversial in philosophical terms. Sometimes I do, and I try to identify it, but what I'm telling you tonight is things which professional philosophers would find quite unexciting. And that's my goal, to make it unexciting and therefore probably true. Okay.
Thank you very much for coming. Just as Robert Gottlieb mentioned, Robert Gottlieb is speaking tomorrow night at JLE at 8 o'clock on Are There Absolute Values. You're speaking.